You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. In the world of ufology, for many, one case is considered to be where it all began. And of course, that is the Roswell incident. One man has spent decades researching this enigmatic event, and that man is Tom Carey. In his latest book, co-authored with Donald Schmidt, Touched by Roswell, Crash Encounters of the Rich and Famous, Tom and Donald provide us with a who's who of people with some unusual connections to the event, from the Fonz to John Denver, and even Elvis Presley. You may be very surprised to discover some of the people who seem to be obsessed or even involved in some aspect of the Roswell crash. From stars of stage and screen to kings and musicians, Roswell still seems to captivate many, even to this day. Tom and I discuss some of the personalities and celebrities included in his book with a couple of very unusual first-hand encounters. A big thank you to Tom for joining me on this week's show. As always, you can support the show by clicking on our link to sign up for Patreon for $4 a month for ad-free episodes, early releases and bonus content. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube, and the website is, of course, mysteriesandmonsters.com. A big thank you, as always, to Dean Bestel for the artwork, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. One night in July 1947, and for many, life in New Mexico and beyond would never be the same again. On today's show, I am delighted to be joined by best-selling investigative author Thomas J. Carey. Thomas has been a MUFON State Section Director for Southeastern Pennsylvania, a special investigator for SUFOS, and has authored and co-authored over 40 articles about the Roswell event. With numerous television appearances and interviews with some of the biggest names in investigative journalism, Thomas's reputation speaks volumes for the regard he is held in. Tom, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. How are you?
Nice to be with you, Paul.
Thank you for joining me.
It's been my pleasure, and I look forward to our show.
Yes, very much so. Roswell's one of those subjects, Tom, I think, for anybody like myself who kind of got into mysteries and monsters and ufology fully sort of at the beginning of the 90s. And I found it amazing that here we are 30 years later and people still have such an appetite for Roswell. Do you think that's just because of the level of what went on and what's gone on since, Tom? Or do you think that people just can't get enough of it?
You know, Paul, that's a good question. We get it often. And I have to believe that, you know, for me, I was interested in, you know, UFOs, you know, just generally UFOs. But when I read the first book about Roswell in 1980 called The Roswell Incident, it just blew me away. And I lost most of my interest in other UFOs. And just this one case fascinated me. And the reason is that unlike your other cases where so many of them are just lights in the sky. I saw this light, it would move fast, it made right turns and all that sort of stuff. This case has everything. It's not lights in the sky. It's the crash of a nuts and bolts machine, a flying disc, a flying saucer, UFO, whatever you want to call it. It's a nuts and bolts machine, and it has bodies as well, not just wreckage. It also had bodies. Back then in 1947, They called them the firsthand witnesses called them little people. They called them little people. They didn't call them aliens or sometimes they called them Martians, because that was the term used back then, was especially in the War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds story.
Mm.
They called them Martians, but they didn't call them aliens back then. So it had wreckage. It had little bodies. It had a cover-up. The U.S. Air Force, the Army Air Force, said it was a crash of a flying saucer.
Mm.
Then they retracted that story within hours, and there was a cover-up. The UFO cover-up began with Roswell, at least in the United States. You had the big influx of UFO reports beginning in June of 1947, with the Kenneth Arnold sighting, and that was the beginning of the modern age of UFOs, because UFOs had been sighted, at least in my opinion, all the time, forever.
Mm.
You know, people saw things, strange things in the sky forever. But in 1947, in the summer of 1947, all of a sudden there was this huge wave of UFO sightings. And the Roswell incident and the Roswell crash occurred about a week and a half after the beginning of this. Kenneth Arnold saw his nine flying saucers in June 24th, 1947.
Yeah.
Week and a half later, you have the Roswell crash. So it's, so there was no antecedent, there was no precedent for on how to handle these things. So they. First, they put out a story where they found the flying saucer crashed. It was recovered by the Roswell Army Airfield, which was located in Roswell, New Mexico.
Hmm.
And so that headline went out. It got on the press wire and went around the world. And within hours, however, the U.S. government, the Army Air Forces decided that wasn't the way to go. They decided let's cover this thing up. We don't know what this is. We don't want the Russians to get hold of this because the Cold War had just started.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get the press, because the press was interested in this. Like I said, they started the sheriff's department in Roswell, as well as the base in Roswell, they started being deluged with phone calls from all around the world. People, what is this? Can we get some more information about this? So it was the whole world was excited, and the government basically they didn't know what to do. They said, so when they don't know what to do, let's cover this up. We gotta kill this story in the press till we figure out what this is and what to do about it. So they put out this phony weather balloon story. Now, had they said that it was the crash of an experimental aircraft, something like that, it would have been more believable. But it went from a flying saucer that came from another world, another planet somewhere in the universe, to a weather balloon. Now, that's quite a difference, you know. If they had said it was a crash of a V-2 rocket that they were testing, the captured German V-2 rockets.
Yeah,
or a experimental aircraft of some sort. They didn't realize what they had. It was just one of those things. We wouldn't be talking today.
Yeah.
We would not be talking today. The story was so cockamamie, so ludicrous that the base intelligence officer Jesse Marcel from the Roswell Army Air Base. And this is the 509th Bomb Group. Now, the 509th Bomb Group, located at Roswell, was the outfit that ended World War II by dropping two atomic bombs, one on Hiroshima and one on Nagasaki. This was the elite unit in the United States military.
Yeah.
So how could they mistake a weather balloon, which consists of a rubber or neoprene rubber balloon, a tinfoil radar target that any, you know, and balsa wood that kept it the target together, yeah, that any six-year-old would be able to recognize. How could that confuse the base intelligence officer for the 509th Bomb Group? How could he mistake a rubber balloon, some tinfoil, some baling twine from a spaceship? How could he mistake that? Yeah. And but that's the story they went with. I guess they did know. I guess they cooked it up real quick. And whoever said, let's call it a weather balloon. Like I said, if it had been something else, something more technical, like a jet aircraft that they were testing, because at the time, the United States was testing the Bell X-1 rocket-powered aircraft that they broke the sound barrier with in October of that year. So this is July, so July, August of this. 3 months later, they broke the sound barrier with this Bell X-1 rocket plane. They could have said it was that, you know, and everybody would have gone home and said, oh, well, that's a shame that happened. But they said, no, it's a weather balloon. And, oh, my God. everybody felt really silly that they got all excited over the weather balloon that they came out with. So, like I said, if it had been something else, more technical, we would not be talking today. I mean, the case would have been covered up forever.
Yeah.
And until such time they, you know, felt it was okay to disclose. That's how the case got me interested in it, to the point where I'm not really, I don't follow, you know, the other things. I know Rendlesham is a good case. Mm-hmm. But Rendlesham doesn't have 600 witnesses that Don Schmidt and I have discovered. There's so many witnesses, first and second hand, to this case, and we have a new one this week. Believe it or not, it was the daughter of one of the witnesses who saw the bodies. But we're still getting new witnesses, and we have accumulated a little over 600 first and secondhand witnesses to the case. So it's the best investigated case, but it's also the most interesting case, at least in my judgment, because of the cover-up, the death threats, the wreckage, and the fact that we are still, like I said, this week we got another witness. Now Rendlesham is a good case. It's more of a landing than a crash, right? It's just it was a landing, and I think there's a few Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt plus a few of his enlisted men who were involved, but there's like only a handful. But that's probably the second best case. Now there's a case in Australia called the Westall.
Yes,
Westall case. I believe there are many, many witnesses. There was a landing at a school there where a lot of children saw it. Mm-hmm. That is a good case. I believe that was 1966 that occurred.
Yep.
And then in 1994, there's another landing in Zimbabwe, Africa.
Yep. Yeah, at another school.
Another school. So to me, Roswell, of course, is the top because we have so many witnesses that we have interviewed, right? Mm. But you have Rendlesham, Westall, Zimbabwe. Those are the top four cases right off the top of my head. There might be another one that escapes me at the moment, but those are the four top cases of all time, at least in my judgment, Paul.
Yeah. The thing I've often been fascinated with the Roswell cases, for a lot of people, really, and especially as you touched on there, Tom, because of 1947 being the summer of the saucer, and it suddenly coming across into the mainstream, you had so many sort of strange things going on in the 50s. You had Adamski claiming he was communicating with aliens and writing his books and creating this kind of quasi-religious following.
I've read some of them when I was younger. I read George Adamski. Yes, he was a hamburger flipper in Los Angeles, and he claimed he was a astronomer, I think, or something like that. But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you're okay. So it's really interesting because there are some pivotal cases that occur after Roswell. And I think that speaks volumes to the level of cover-up that went on, Tom. Because obviously, back in those days, you know, it's nearly 75 years ago now, clearly, if people were told to be quiet and not say anything or something may happen, then people actually listened to what they were being told and just kept stum. And yet, I've seen, I think you mentioned it in the book, when Jesse Marcel appears on In Search Of, which I think that episode was broadcast in 1980, I think?
Yes.
That was the first time he'd actually come forward, or it was the first time television had actually covered this case. And I've seen that episode a few times, Tom, because I'm a massive fan of In Search Of, because I missed it when it was on over here in the UK when I was a lad. So I've caught it in sort of the last 5 years, and I love it. And it's remarkable looking at him as he's walking through that meadow where the sheep are, which is supposed to be the alleged crash site where he recovered the pieces. It's remarkable that he still felt so passionate 33 years on, Tom, that he had to come forward. And I think that's when the floodgates opened, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. 1980, there was a show called In Search Of. It was a half-hour show, and the host of it was Leonard Nimoy. But in 1980... he had this show, and they did this show on Roswell. It was a, as you said, it was Jesse Marcel. They went out to the crash site where Jesse went in 1947, walking the desert floor out there, and that was the first TV airing of this Roswell incident. This is 1980, the same year that the first Roswell book came out, this the Roswell incident by William Moore and Charles Berlitz. And also one other thing happened in 1980 was a movie, motion picture called The Hangar 18 came out. Now, Hangar 18, I remember when that came out also in 1980, I knew what Hangar 18 meant. It meant it was a hangar at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. In Dayton, Ohio, where rumor had it that they had UFO crash wreckage there, and little alien bodies were stored there. Now, how did I know already that Hangar 18? Well, how did I already hear of Hangar 18 when yet I had not heard of the Roswell case? Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was in 1974. I was living in California with my wife and two children. I had a 6-year-old son. We lived in Sacramento, California, and I had decided to go to the University of Toronto in Canada to get a doctorate in anthropology. So we drove cross country in my Volkswagen Beetle. We drove cross country to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where my parents live, to stop over before we went to Toronto. And so it's 1974, and I'm about to take off for Toronto, and there's this story on the radio of this fellow in Florida. They call it, he was professor. He called himself professor. He was not really a professor, but somehow he started calling himself Professor Robert Spencer Carr. Started talking. Now, he was in Florida. Now, Florida was a retirement place for a lot of ex-military people. They would retire to Florida because of nice warm weather all the time. Mm-hmm. And he had heard a lot of stories. He was a UFO guy, and he gave talks on UFOs down there. And after he would give a talk, you know, people would come up to him and tell him little stories about this. Oh, I saw a flying saucer. I saw this. I saw that. We had a number of former military veterans told him about this hangar at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base because they were stationed there. And there was this hangar where the rumor was that that's where all flying saucer material and bodies were stored. So he got enough of those stories that he somehow got the attention of the news media. And he started talking about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And that's where UFOs, were stored, that the crashed UFOs, that's where little bodies are stored, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember hearing that story on the radio in 1974 as I was taking off to go to Toronto to continue my anthropology studies. And I remember by the time I got to Toronto, the story was no longer in the news. So I didn't know any more about it. But that's how I heard about Hangar 18. I didn't connect it with Roswell because that's like 6 years before the first Roswell story, first Roswell book came out. So that's how I knew about Hangar 18, was from Robert Spencer Carr, who was telling these stories in 1974. So in 1980, you have the book comes out. You have the In Search of TV show with Jesse Marcel, who actually had broken silence 2 years earlier. He was a ham radio operator, and he had a little circle of friends that he started talking about Roswell in 1978. But to continue the 1980 nexus with the Hangar 18 movie, I knew what they were talking about. It starred Robert Vaughn, who was famous for this show, 1960s show, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. It was a big TV show. I don't know if it was in the U.K., but a big TV show over here, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And he was the star of the movie. And I couldn't tell you who else was in it right off the top of my head. But so you have those three things happening in 1980. And believe it or not, Paul, it was another 11 years before the next Roswell book. Another 11 years. And that was by Kevin Randall and Donald Schmidt.
Yep.
And that was called UFO Crash at Roswell. And it's my belief that it was that book that really made the case take off, because the original Roswell incident book, I remember reading it, and I remember being confused about the Mac Brazel story, who found the wreckage on his ranch, his sheep ranch in New Mexico. They had that story, but then they had another story about this fellow named Barney Barnett, 150 miles to the west of Roswell. He claimed to have come across a downed saucer with little beings in it. See, the Mac Brazel story never had any little beings in it. It was all wreckage. But the Barney Barnett story, which occurred on the plains of San Augustine, just south of Socorro, southwest of Socorro, New Mexico, there's where they brought in the bodies. Actually, in our investigation, we were able to determine that nothing in 1947 of that nature occurred on the plains of San Augustine. We interviewed a lot of archaeologists who were out there at the time, and nothing took place on the plains of San Augustine, southwest of Socorro, in 1947. And that was a single witness case. That was the big difference. That was a single witness case, this Barney Barnett fellow who worked for the government. But so we had to take that case out of the Roswell story. And we were able to determine that there were bodies. There were actually three sites, three crash sites associated with the Roswell case. You had the Mac Brazel, the sheep rancher. That's where we believe the UFO exploded over his ranch on the evening of July 2nd, 1947, with a light, but because of a lightning strike. It was either an internal explosion, which we don't know about, or a lightning strike, which a lot of the witnesses remember hearing this muffled explosion during a severe thunder and lightning storm. So that's how we were able to point it to July 2nd. And so what happened was when the ship exploded, we believe that two of the beings inside, the entities, the beings, the aliens, were thrown out in the blast. And came to fall and met their demise 2.5 miles east of the Brazel site. So that's the second site. Two bodies and a little bit of wreckage. The internal cabin of the ship was able to withstand, we believe, the explosion. So you have the ship, the exterior disintegrating and raining all this wreckage down on the Brazel Ranch.
Yep.
You have these two beings thrown out of the ship and come to rest and met their demise on a low bluff 2.5 miles east of that of the Brazel site. But you have the inner cabin continues on for another 30 to 35 miles, coming to rest just about 32 miles north-northwest of the town of Roswell. It comes to rest on the desert floor. You have two more dead bodies. There's two dead that were found, but there was one at that site. We call it the impact site. That's the third site where two bodies were found, but one was one of the third entity at that site was still alive. So you have a total of five entities, five beings, so five aliens, four of whom met their fate and one that survived the lightning strike and the crash and the landing, and he survived. Survived.
Yeah.
So those are the three sites. We took the Socorro site out of the timeline. It had nothing to do. If anything happened there, it wasn't in 1947. So that's the timeline. And Brazel discovered the wreckage the next day on July the 3rd. On July the 4th, it was Independence Day, the U.S. Independence Day, big celebration. And on July the 5th, he goes into town, into Roswell, and we believe that just before he went into town, he discovered the two bodies that were blown out of the ship 2.5 miles, still on his ranch, but 2.5 miles east of the Brazel site. He discovered those at some point after he found the wreckage, and it spurred him on to go to Roswell and report it. He was concerned about getting his ranch cleaned up. He didn't know what it was that had crashed. He didn't know because he didn't have a radio, and he only got like a monthly newspaper. So he was puzzled.
Yep.
He drove to Roswell on the July the 6th. It was a Sunday. And yes, it was a Sunday, July the 6th. And that began the so-called Roswell timeline, because he reported it to the sheriff. The sheriff calls the base, the air base in town, and that's when Jesse Marshall goes out to the site and discovers the crashed UFO.
And the rest is history, as they say, Tom.
And the rest is history, yes.
I mean, obviously in your new book that you've co-authored with Donald Schmidt, Touched by Roswell, the thing that I found incredible about this is some of the people that have a first or second person based connection with this case. And as you refer to there, you're talking about the Socorro incident, which is often one of those things that, unless you really look into it, it still crops up now and again, Tom, that people talk about the Socorro.
We did, Paul, when I joined the Randall and Schmidt team, the Socorro case was still in play.
Mm.
And we did investigate that, and I went out. I've been to the plains of San Augustine myself, and I have a huge 2-foot by 3-foot photo in my dining room at home here of the picture I took of the plains of San Augustine. And the picture came out so beautifully, I said, "Oh, well, I have to put that up on the wall." And so I sent it away, and they blew it up to a 2-foot by 3-foot canvas. And it's hanging in my dining room as we speak.
But the thing that made me chuckle about that when I'm reading through the book is you were able to kind of investigate that case due to Ted Danson's dad, wasn't it?
Yes, Ted Danson. You're talking about Ted Danson from Cheers?
Yes.
Yes, his father, he's in our book. We have a nice big picture of Ted Danson and his father. From Ted Danson, the bartender Sam Malone from Cheers. And Ted Danson's father was a graduate student at Harvard College at the time. It's now Harvard University. And generally considered one of the top universities in the United States. And he was an archaeology student, archaeology graduate student. And he was part of a team that summer of 1947 It was called the Upper Gila. The Gila is a in Arizona, the Upper Gila Formation. And he and James Otis Brew, who was the head of the archaeological team, they were conducting a surveillance of this Upper Gila Formation that ran from in Arizona into New Mexico, into the plains of San Augustine. So I found out this information from one of the archaeological journals at the University of Pennsylvania. I went down and did some research, and they had this archaeological journal that comes out. I don't know if it's monthly or bi-monthly, but it's called American Archaeology. And the January issue of every year, they do a recapitulation of what took place in archaeology in the United States over the past years. So I got the January 1948 edition, and I found out that in the summer of 47, this team from Harvard that consisted of James Otis Brew and Edwin Danson had conducted this expedition. It went from Arizona, and in the later summer, they went into the plains of San Augustine in New Mexico. So back then, we didn't have the internet or computers or anything like that, and I didn't know where I didn't even know if Danson was still alive or not. So I wrote a letter to Ted Danson, who was the star of Cheers, care of I don't know who the if it was Paramount or whatever the host producing company was, but I wrote to the to Ted Danson, care of the producing company of his show. I understand your father is a Harvard archaeologist, blah, 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 blah. I understand that he was in New Mexico in 1947. Could you have him get in touch with me? I would like to interview him. So a couple weeks go by, and I got a letter from Edward, his nickname was Ned, N-E-D, as opposed to Ted, his son's name. He was generally known to his family as Ned Danson, but I just knew him as Edwin or Edward Danson. And he wrote to me a couple weeks later saying, oh, thank you, blah, blah, blah. Yes, I was out. We were on the plains of San Augustine that summer of 1947, but as far as we know, nothing happened there. So I thanked him, and I wrote him back, and I said, well, can you send me a picture of yourself? Because I'd like to, if we have a book about this, I'd like to say that we talked to you, and you confirmed that nothing happened on the plains of San Augustine in 1947. So that's the picture you see in this book. And in fact, it's a very large picture, as you can see, in this book that just came out, which is called Touched by Roswell, Crash Encounters of the Rich and Famous. Now, Ted Danson, everybody pretty much knows who he is around the world, but they didn't know that his father was a Harvard archaeologist of some renown.
Yeah.
And so we have a whole section on Edwin Danson, and I'm looking – I have the book in my hand. I'm looking for his picture. And it's a color picture. Anyway, he sent it to me, and I still have it. And the book, Touched by Roswell, it's produced by Philip Mantle of the United Kingdom, London. It's by Don Schmidt and myself, with a foreword by Roy Thinnes. Now, I don't know if you remember who Roy Thinnes was.
Mm-hmm. I do.
When I was in college, undergraduate, at Temple University in Philadelphia, Roy Thinnes starred in a TV show called The Invaders.
Yep.
It was the only UFO type show on TV at the time, and I think it ran for 2 years, 1967 and 1968. And Roy Thinnes was a star. His last name was Vincent. I forget what his first name was in the show, but he knew that the UFOs were here, that they had landed and they were trying to take over the world, and only he knew And he was trying to get to convince others that they were here and they had sinister objectives in taking over the world. Roy Thinnes was the star. He was also in a number of motion pictures. The one that comes to my mind is the Hindenburg. He had a starring role with George C. Scott.
Yeah.
In the Hindenburg. And quite frankly, Paul, I was never able to figure out why he didn't become a Paul Newman, Steve McQueen type motion picture star, because he was very good looking, had blonde hair and blue eyes, and very athletic. He did his own stunts, and I'm thinking, wow, he should have been like Paul Newman and Steve McQueen in those types of movies. And but I think what happened, Paul, is that he got typecast.
Yeah,
he got typecasted in this Invaders role. And whenever anybody saw him, they thought of the Invaders. And that's like the kiss of death to an actor.
Yeah.
Is to be typecast in one role that you can't get out of.
Yeah.
So I believe that's what happened to him. But he wrote the foreword to our book. He's been a good friend of Don Schmidt's all these years.
Hmm.
And we have a whole section on Roy Thinnes. And in the book, I actually counted up how many people we have identified as having somewhere in their life being touched by Roswell. And I don't mean being like a witness. This is not like a witness book, like a list of, okay, you have Jesse Marcel and you have Frank Joyce and you have so on. It's not that at all. It's a list of book of famous, rich and famous people, like actors, actresses. We even have the very first person in that we identify in the book is the Prince Hans Adam II of Liechtenstein.
Yes.
that small country in Europe. Prince Hans Adam II, he's now the head of Liechtenstein, a beautiful, beautiful little country. I hope to go there before I check out, because all the pictures I see of it are very appealing.
Mm.
And, of course, we also would like to go to England and to, of course, my great-grandfather came from Ireland.
Yeah.
Dennis Carey.
Yeah.
he came from Ireland. We'd like to go to Ireland, England, and Scotland and Wales.
Yeah.
And before we check out, and I know my wife would like to go there first,
mm.
but that somewhere in that trip, I'd also like to check with Prince Hans Adam II of Liechtenstein. Now, what is his connection to Roswell? Well, somewhere along the line, the Prince Hans Adam became interested in the Roswell case. And in 1990, he funded a big confab in Washington, D.C. of all the firsthand witnesses that we were aware of that could make it over a few days to video record the statements of all of the firsthand witnesses that we were aware of at the time that could, make it to Washington. And there were 27 of them. And they're all dead now, unfortunately. But there were 27 of them. They videotaped their statements. And 2 years later, in 1992, they published, I guess that would be the word, the VHS videotape called Recollections of Roswell. I have a copy. I still use it today to refresh my mind on somebody's testimony. And there are witnesses like John Crumb Schroeder, who was a dentist, who knew Pappy Henderson, who was a pilot that flew the bodies. There's a statement of Barbara Duggar, who was the granddaughter of Sheriff George Wilcox, who got really roughed up by the Air Force after helping them cover up the case. They roughed him up and said, well, if you ever speak about this, we're going to kill you. We're going to kill your wife, Inez, and we're going to kill all your children and your families. And so how's that for a thank you? So anyway, that's how Hans Adam II, who's now the head of state of Liechtenstein, the richest head of state in Europe and the fourth richest head of state in the world. That's how he became involved in Roswell. He sponsored this huge get together in Washington, D.C., and there was quite an event. And so he's the first one we talk about in the book, Touched by Roswell.
Yeah.
Like I said, there are 100, I counted them up. I went through the book and I counted them up. There's 126 plus or minus one. I have to give myself a little leeway there. 126 plus or minus one people that we have identified as being touched in their lives by the Roswell case. And we have, just looking at Dr. Wernher von Braun, yeah, we have an NFL football player who played for my local team here, the Philadelphia Eagles, named Tom Brookshire. He was involved.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, that, because as a kid, he was a gas pump attendant. Wasn't he actually from Roswell?
Yes. That is a very interesting story.
Mm.
I knew Tom Brookshire, not personally, but as a football player for the Philadelphia Eagles in the late 1950s and up through 1961, where he broke his leg. He broke his tibia in 1961, and he never played again. And what happened to him was he went on to become the top National Football League announcer for games in the 1970s. He became an announcer, and he was like one of their top announcers through the 1970s. And in the 1980s, after he left that position, he started All Sports Talk Radio in Philadelphia. All Sports 24/7 Sports Talk Radio in Philadelphia. He started that. He had his own show. He was part owner of the station. And his show that he started, it's still the most popular sports talk radio show in Philadelphia. Now, he died in 2010, and I was able to interview him in 2008.
Yeah.
And how that came about was I didn't even know he was from Roswell, you know?
Yeah.
So in 2008, I took my wife with me. I always go down, as Don Schmidt does. We're speakers every July in Roswell during their UFO festival they have in July.
Yeah.
So we've been speakers there. Don's on the board of directors of the big UFO museum there, but I've been a speaker there for 25 years. And in 2008, I took my wife with me down to Roswell to show her what it was like, what Roswell was like, what I did. And so so we're down there. And so one day, this is before I had to actually become a speaker. I showed my wife around Roswell, and we came upon this football stadium of the New Mexico Military Institute. The New Mexico Military Institute. It's a secondary school for boys, military type school.
Yeah.
And so we're looking at I'm looking at the stadium, looking at the stands and the grass and all that sort of stuff. And my wife walks off, and then she yells to me to come over, to come over where she is. So I went over, and she's pointing to this bronze plaque that's right outside the stadium. This bronze plaque, I'd say it's about 2.5 feet by 2 by 3 feet, something like that. It had all these names embedded in it. And I'm looking at these names, and they were all players, football players, who had played at that stadium at some time in their life, probably in high school.
Yeah.
That went on to play in the National Football League. There were about 12 names. I recognized Roger Staubach's name, famous quarterback, and a few others' names. But the first name on this plaque was Tom Brookshire. I said, oh, my God, Tom Brookshire. And, I said, wow, I didn't know he was from Roswell or played here. So I made a point to call him when we got back home we were living, Huntington Valley, where I live now. I said, I got to call him when I get back home. So we get back home, and I call him up, I got his phone number from, so I did have the internet. That's how I got, I got his location and number from the internet. And I called him up and I got an answering machine. So I said, okay, I got to leave him a message to show him I know what I'm talking about and that he would want to call me back. So I said, dear Tom, this is Tom Carey, and I'm calling you about I had you were from Roswell, New Mexico. I'd like to talk to you if you know anything about that famous UFO crash that happened there in 1947. And by the way, Tom, you were a great football player, but you were a great defensive back. You could cover a lot of good receivers, but you couldn't cover number 23 for the Cleveland Browns. So I figured that he called me. He calls me back in 10 minutes. And he says, Carey, you don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what game you were watching, but I could too cover the guy's name was Ray Renfro, number 23 from the Cleveland Browns. I said, well, I saw him catch a touchdown pass on you. He said, well, that was just one time. That was just a mistake. But I happened to see that, and that's why I said you couldn't cover Ray Renfro. Anyway, we had a nice hour and a half talk. And it turned out that his father owned a gas station, a service station on Main Street in Roswell.
Mm.
And Tom, during the summertime, used to pump gas there because, you know, he was off from school and he would pump gas and, you know, be sort of a gopher, you know, do odd things around the gas station in the summertime. And he got to know a lot of the airmen at the base because of that. They would come into his father's service station to fill up their gas tanks. Mm. And so he got to know a number of them. He said, but what happened was when this thing happened, the crash, the base went into a lockdown and nobody was getting in or coming out for about a week during this event, this crash event. And he said, wow, there's nobody. But when the lockdown was lifted, he said, all of a sudden, everything changed. The guys from the base who would come into his father's station wouldn't talk to him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They would not talk to him anymore. And he said, oh, my goodness, what's going on here? They won't talk to me. And he said, after that, the town and the base was never the same between the base and the town again.
Yeah.
Because the base, obviously the airmen on the base were instructed not to talk to anybody in Roswell about what happened. So basically they took it to mean don't talk to anybody, period, you know.
Yeah.
So that was one part of his story. It was the lockdown. The other part was some of his high school football friends, because Tom was a star athlete at Roswell High School.
Hmm.
And he played football, basketball, and baseball. But some of his football buddies, they came over to the gas station. And they said, hey, Tom, do you know what Roy Tyner has over there in his welding? Roy Tyner had a welding shop in Roswell.
Hmm.
And they said, have you seen that Roy Tyner has this magical piece of metal that does tricks? And so Brookshire says, you know, what are you talking about? He says, well, he's got this piece of metal that we've never seen anything like it before. So they all go over to Roy Tyner. So Tom Brookshire has to see this because he doesn't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So they all walk around the corner to Roy Tyner's welding shop. So in they go, and Roy Tyner says, what do you guys want? Get out of here. You know, I'm busy. Can't you see I'm busy? Get out of here. He said. So they say, we're not leaving till you show us that funny piece of metal you have. So Roy Tyner figures, well, I'm not going to get rid of them, so I guess I'll have to show them this piece of metal. So he goes over to his desk and opens a drawer and pulls out this piece of metal that he wads up in his hand.
Hmm.
So he goes back to the boys and he holds his arm out chest high. He holds his fist out towards the boys. And so he opens his fist and out floats this thin piece of metal, looked like aluminum, very thin, but instead of falling to the floor, it unfurls itself from being wadded up in Roy's hand. It unfurls itself. It just floats there in midair. It's just floating, slowly floating in midair. So the boys are, you know, Brookshire's dumbfounded. He says, do that again. So Roy grabs this piece of metal, wads it up again in his hand, and then holds it out, his arm out towards the boys, and lets it go. And there it is again, just floating slowly in the floor, ever slowly falling, you know, just floating. It didn't drop to the floor, just gently floated to the floor.
Yeah.
And they're like, my God, Roy, where did you get that? They said, well, he said, I got it from a friend of mine who took it from the crash site of a flying saucer north of town. That's all he told me. He said, now get out of here. So Brookshire is a firsthand witness to viewing, and I believe he held it in his hand. I think he said, let me see that, and he held it in his hand. Mm. So he's a firsthand witness, one, to the lockdown, and two, to this, what we call memory metal, the three crash sites of the Roswell case had a lot of this memory metal amongst the wreckage.
Yeah.
It was a lot of it because all the witnesses who were at the crash sites talk about this memory metal.
Yeah.
So Brookshire was a firsthand witness, and I didn't even know he was from Roswell, and it turns out that he was not only from Roswell, but a firsthand witness.
It's remarkable because there are a couple of other names in the book, Tom, that made me just smile. Henry Winkler is one, because I think Henry Winkler, who obviously most people will know, we were talking about being typecast earlier, is synonymous with being the Fonz from Happy Days. But I think a lot of people forget that he was obviously moved into production a lot in American TV and was one of the people responsible for bringing Sightings to television. So, I mean, obviously Sightings was shown over here as well. So it always makes me chuckle because I still watch it now and again, Tom, because all the episodes are on YouTube. You can find them all over the place. And it's always made me chuckle whenever I saw his name pop up at the end, because he's one of those people that you just wouldn't presume would have an interest in this. But he had a real interest in it and wanted to know more, didn't he?
The Fonz, yes. I forget what his first name was, but Fonzarelli.
Arthur. Was it Arthur Fonzarelli?
Arthur J. Fonzarelli, also known as the Fonz.
Yeah.
In Happy Days. Like you said, he went into producing, and the first he produced this show called Sightings. I remember I used to watch it myself, but I didn't know the first episode of Sightings. I learned this from my co-author, Don Schmidt, who's still good friends with Winkler, that the first show on Sightings was about Roswell.
Yeah.
And Winkler remains a fan, he's, you know, still interested in the Roswell case today. And I didn't know that, but Don Schmidt knows him, and the Fonz was a Roswell and still is a Roswell fan. Now, what's interesting also, Paul, is that his cohort there on Happy Days, Ron Howard, became a famous producer-director of many motion pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And currently, most recently, you know, our book, A Witness to Roswell, which was our first book, came out in 2007, and we had a second edition of it in 2009. And the second edition was optioned by a company called Stellar Productions in Hollywood. And the head of Stellar Productions, his name is Bryce Zabel, but the other head of Roswell, the Stellar Productions, is Donnie Most, who played Ralph Mouth in Happy Days. And so they optioned our book, A Witness to Roswell. And recently, Bryce Zabel is a screenwriter, and he wrote screenwrote Witness to Roswell.
Mm.
And within the last few months, Ron Howard has asked to see the script for Witness to Roswell. This is within the last 3 months.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes. So I don't know if he's going forward with it or not, but we didn't shop it to him. He came to us. within the last 3 months to see Bryce Sable's script for Roswell.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Well, so clearly there's a lot of interest from the Happy Days cast in ufology then, Tom.
Yes. Yes.
For whatever reason.
Yes, I remember we, Don Schmidt and I, took Bryce Sable and Don Most around. We showed them the old air base down in Roswell. We took them to the air base and showed them where the, you know, where the base hospital used to be, where a aborted autopsy was attempted.
Yeah.
Some of the other points around the base. Most of the points on the base that were involved back in 47 are gone now.
Mm.
The hospital's gone. The guest house where Mac Brazel was sequestered for a week to get him to change his story, that has been recently torn down. And I just when I hear that, I just, oh my goodness, what are they doing? Yeah. These are all historical monuments to me.
Yes.
Because the town of Roswell is known for one thing, as you know.
Yeah.
You can go to Upper Volta and mention Roswell. They know you're talking about the crash of a UFO. You can go to Liechtenstein or any country in the world, and they know about Roswell. And it's not about their cheese factory. It's about the Roswell crash. Yeah. And they've torn down everything that – most things are gone now except the old hangar. Mm. The base hangar there at Roswell is still there. It's still a functioning hangar. And that's where all the wreckage and the bodies were first – when they – came to town, they went into that hangar, and that, thank God, that hangar is still there. It's still a working hangar, but most everything else is gone.
I must admit, when I was reading your book, Tom, there was several names, and the last one I'll mention is one of those where you don't know anything about this until you read your book, is Huey Green. Now, you may not be aware, but Huey Green was an absolute megastar in the UK through a TV show called Opportunity Knox. So I grew up with him being one of the prime-time superstars of British television as a kid.
Huey Green?
Yeah, Hugh Green.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And then to read your bit in the book where he was travelling, he'd been filming, but he was a serviceman as well, wasn't he?
You know why Huey Green is in the book?
Yeah, that's the thing that I found remarkable is that he just basically said, oh, yeah, I was listening to the radio because I was driving.
Here's why he's in the book, because in the original Roswell incident book that came out in 1980, the first book, there's a whole section on Huey Green. They have a picture of him in uniform, but it's actually a Royal Canadian Air Force uniform.
Yeah.
Not the RAF, but the RCAF, the Royal Canadian Air Force uniform.
Yeah.
And so he was traveling cross country from California to Philadelphia, but they don't explain why.
Yeah.
They don't explain why he was traveling from California to Philadelphia. And during the trip, he was traveling by car. He heard the radio news broadcast of the crash. So this would be right at the time of the crash. In 47, he hears these radio news reports about the Roswell crash.
Mm.
And by the time he gets to Philadelphia, the story is over, because he said he got to Philadelphia and nobody knew what they said. Oh, that they haven't said anything more about it in a couple of days about the story. So he didn't know any more about it. But I remember thinking, well, whatever became of Huey Green? Why was he traveling from California to Philadelphia? And so I said, was he, you know, I'm thinking, well, he must have been an airman in the Air Force. But I was really confused about who he was and what he was doing. Mm. Well, I'm watching, I'm a big fan of Turner Classic Movies here in the U.S., the old movies. So I turn on the TV and this movie, If Winter Comes, is just getting over, and they're going to the scroll of who played what.
Yeah.
And I just happened to see the name Hugh Green. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'll bet that's Huey Green. Yeah, I just happened to catch the name in the scroll, Hugh Green. So I made sure, because I didn't know if that was the Huey Green or somebody else.
Yeah.
So the next time If Winter Comes was on the TV, I made a point to watch it. And sure enough, I said, that's Huey Green. He had just a little minor role in the movie. You only see him once or twice. I said, that's Huey Green. So I read up on the movie If Winter Comes. Well, it turns out the movie If Winter Comes was set in England.
Hmm.
It was set in England, but was filmed in Florida and in Hollywood. That's where the movie was filmed. It was filmed in the state of Florida, and some scenes were filmed in Hollywood.
Hmm.
So Huey Green was coming, and the movie finished up. They finished up in July of 47. The movie, it only took a couple months to make the movie, and they finished it in July of 47. So he was coming from Hollywood from having just finished this movie, If Winter Comes. He was coming from Hollywood because of that movie, and he was going back. He had to have had his wife with him. He was going back to England. He was returning to England via Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He had lived in Canada for, he joined the RCAF. He got caught in Canada when World War II started.
Yeah.
Because he was over there in some play that they were doing a tour in Canada when World War II started. England joined the war, declared war in Germany. And so he was stuck in Canada for the duration, and he joined the RCAF, and he married a Canadian woman. And so at some point he became an actor, and they made this movie, and he was on his way back to England from having been in Hollywood, and that's why he was driving cross country. So then I found out, I didn't know what he did, but he was a big television star in England, right?
Yeah, massive.
The reason was he was involved. He was a firsthand witness to listening to the radio broadcasts of the news shows talking about the Roswell crash. But I was curious as to why was he, he was English. Why was he, I thought he was in an RAF uniform, but it was an RCAF.
Mm.
And where was he coming from and where was he going and that sort of thing, and what became of him?
Yeah. I mean, it is a great book because you'd learn so much, because like I say, I was not aware of that witness. And the connections, obviously, to British culture and things like that, Tom. It just made me raise my eyebrows with a little chuckle. So, I mean, the book's jam packed full of little interesting tidbits like that about other people, as we've touched on. You know, you've got other musicians like Dwight Yoakam and Ozzy Osbourne in there as well, and several other people and senators and things. So, for you, going forwards, I know you mentioned this earlier, you're still getting witnesses forward. Are you still surprised that every time we think we've learned everything we need to know about Roswell, Tom, something else just pops up out of the woodwork?
Yes. We did this book, Touched by Roswell, Crash Encounters of the Rich and Famous, because in our previous book, which we thought was going to be the last book.
Yes.
Our last book, not this one, but the previous book was called Roswell, The Ultimate Cold Case Closed. So we thought that was going to be the last Roswell book we did. And in that book, we did a chapter, actually I wrote it, called Touched by Roswell. It was just one of the chapters in our previous book, Touched by Roswell. And we had a lot of feedback. That book, by the way, has become it's got four and a half out of five stars on Amazon. And we didn't realize that a lot of people think that was up to this book. That was our best book, even better than Witness to Roswell. And that really surprised us.
Hmm.
But that's what they're saying. And so we thought, oh, my goodness, we've had a lot of feedback. And they really liked that chapter called Touched by Roswell because it was so different. It was not just a recapitulation of all the witnesses and you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And we had Don Schmidt had the idea. I have to give him credit for that maybe we can make an entire book about this.
Hmm.
And I thought, oh, my goodness, another Roswell book. And so we thought about it, and we said, yeah, well, let's do it. Do we have enough names? And like I said earlier, I count 126 plus or minus one people that we have identified in the book. 65 of them we go into real depth, like with Huey Green.
Mm-hmm.
The Crown Prince of Liechtenstein, and 65 altogether we do in depth, and the other 60 we do a couple sentences on, because if we did all 126 we'd have a book 3 inches thick, you know.
Yeah,
so we do about we do half of them in Robert Stack. I'm looking at Robert Stack right now. Did you get the now? What is he most famous for? The actor Robert Stack.
Well, over here, he's synonymous with Unsolved Mysteries.
Yes. He did the Unsolved Mysteries. Yes, that was his last main TV show.
Mm.
But before that, it was The Untouchables.
Yeah, absolutely. An Airplane as well, he's famous for.
Yes. That's right. I mean, he got nominated for an Oscar for, I forget the name of the movie, but it was a serious movie.
Mm.
I can't remember what it was, but he was nominated for an Oscar. Everybody forgets that. They know him for The Untouchables, the movie Airplane,
yes,
and the TV show Unsolved Mysteries. So we have a whole section on him.
Yeah.
Oh, let's see here. Oh, the UFO Museum in Roswell, every time they have the UFO Festival, you know?
Yeah.
They have an honored guest. Every year they bring in usually a famous person. Well, always a famous person. What am I talking about? They've had Roy Thinnes 3 times was the guest of honor.
Yeah.
Adrienne Barbeau, who was the actress in Maud, but she also is famous for Swamp Thing. She was her movie Swamp Things, but she's more famous for Maud, etc., etc.
Escape from New York.
Anne Robinson. Most people don't remember Anne Robinson, but she was the female lead in the first War of the Worlds movie.
Yes.
From 1953. Mm. And because I think there's been at least two, that movie's been redone at least 2 more times.
Yeah.
But we have a picture of her in there with and I remember because I watched this movie when it came out. I was a little kid.
Mm.
And during the movie, she's in her and the male lead, whose name I can't remember, Gene Barry.
Yeah.
Was the male lead. They're in this farmhouse. They're hiding from the aliens. And she's looking out the window, and this arm comes up out of nowhere and grabs her on the shoulder, and it's the arm of one of the beings. And we have a nice picture of that moment in the book. I remember because I had to work real hard to bring that picture up to snuff so we could, you know, actually see it.
Yes.
But, you know, because a lot of the photos, you have to work a lot to make them come to life, print them. And that was one I had to work real hard on. But we have a nice picture of that. I'm looking at it now, of this arm that comes up out of nowhere and touches her on the back. And I remember when I saw that in the movie, I jumped a foot out of my seat.
No, it's a classic. There's just so many little, like I said, little nuggets of trivia and information and things that you just wouldn't even think possible. And there's so many people that have, when we're talking about people like Tom Brookshire and the Fonz and such like, Tom, it is remarkable just how prevalent in American culture Roswell seems to still be.
Yes. Oh, I forgot to mention, Paul, that Anne Robinson was a guest of honor 1 year at the museum. That's why we included her and all the other guests of honor at the Roswell Museum. Like Dwight Yoakam was a guest of honor.
Yeah,
and there were so many of them. They're all in our book here, and some of them Malcolm McDowell is one of them. Do you remember Malcolm McDowell? Yes. And Gordon McRae, star of stage and screen, most famous for his roles in Oklahoma, the movie Oklahoma, and Carousel.
Yes.
A famous singer. He was a singer, but he turned actor. And his most famous roles, I would say, are Oklahoma and Carousel. And that is an interesting story because we have it in the book. He's featured in the book. But the rumor was that and it was actually told by his wife, Sheila McRae, on television that he actually saw the Roswell bodies. He saw the Roswell bodies. And the question we have now, her story, we haven't been able to track. She told it she told it twice on television.
We think one was
the Mike Douglas show, which was an afternoon talk show out of Philadelphia. And we don't know the other show, but we have not been able to track the actual video down to when she said that. But we have several people who remember her saying that on television. So there's no doubt that we believe that Sheila McRae actually said that. And the question was, how did Gordon McRae come to view the bodies? Well, Sheila McRae's story was that he was in the Air Corps, the Air Force, and he was standing guard over that. Well, that didn't make any sense because by 1947, he was already out of the Air Force. He was in the Air Corps in World War II.
Yeah.
But by 47, he's already back on the Broadway stage. But I received an email from somebody when we were talking about this. I think it was on Coast to Coast AM some years ago.
Yeah.
I got an email the next day that the story was that he actually was in California or Nevada, in a singing engagement or acting or something like that. And he was taken, a friend of his who had been in the Air Force had taken him to Area 51. And that's where he saw them. That, to me, makes more sense than the story that Sheila McRae had said that he was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
But that was impossible.
Yeah.
And so we contacted the family because Gordon was dead. Sheila was still alive, but she was in a home in New Jersey for, old folks home.
Yeah.
When you need medical care around, and she was in a old folks home, a nursing home in New Jersey. So we contacted the family, her daughter, and we were all set to go visit with Sheila to get her story, how this came about.
Yeah.
And the family got cold feet. They got cold feet at the last moment. They said, well, my mother has, dementia, and she has good days and bad days. And we said, we'll take a chance. Maybe it'll be a good day. We'll take our chance. But in the end, the family refused to let us interview or go speak with Sheila. And she passed away a few years later. So that's as close as we got. But we thought the story was interesting enough.
Yeah.
To include it in this book because Gordon McRae, he's famous movie star, famous singer, but he had this connection to Roswell and the Roswell bodies that we thought was interesting. It's unsolved. It's like, what's his name? Robert Stack. It's an unsolved mystery, but we thought it was interesting enough to put in the book.
No, definitely. Definitely. It's chock full of really interesting connections. Famous people you would never even imagine have some connection to Roswell.
Elvis Presley has a. I'm not going to go into it because we got to give a little. We have to give a little tease out there, right? We have
absolutely.
To do a little tease. But Elvis Presley is in there as well.
Yeah, I must admit, when I saw that name, I thought, "How on earth is that?" So, let's fish them out there. So, Tom, where can everybody get hold of a copy of Touched by Roswell and keep up to date with yourself?
Well, it's available, of course, at Amazon online. That's the major Barnes & Noble online, Amazon online. Even I buy my books that way. And if you go to our website is down at the moment. There's some sort of mix up. We've had it for years, and we're paid up. There's no doubt about that, but it's down and we don't know why. But when our website comes up, you can go. We have all of our books for sale there. You just click on the cover of the book. It'll take you to Amazon. So, easy way to get to Amazon. But I'm guessing that all of your listeners know how to get to Amazon. So That's where you can get it. Our website, we're hoping it's coming back up soon. It's www.RoswellInvestigator.com. That's all one word, www.RoswellInvestigator.com.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put links to the show notes so everybody can track them down if they want to get that book and the rest of your fantastic work that you've done on this subject, primarily with Don Schmidt as well. Tom, and I just want to say thank you so much for taking us on a trip to Roswell and continuing this mystifying case 74 years on. Thank you for your time today.
Well, Paul, it's been my pleasure, and take care.